Welcome back to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. I'm Dr. Drew Johnson, the director of the center. And today's podcast is an interview with our fellow, Rabbi Dr. Joshua Berman, about his new book, Anima Amim. We do have a few audio discrepancies in this episode as we're trying out a new piece of audio software. So please forgive some of the scratches and bumps in the recording. Hope you enjoy. Anima Amim, does that phrase come from somewhere?
Sure, yeah. It's actually the, so Maimonides is the one who came up with these 13 principles, but they're kind of in essay form. And then there's a liturgical poem that boils them down to one sentence statements, which is now found in the standard prayer book. And each of those phrases begins, Anima Amin, I believe that. And that's just
amazing.
It's also the name of the catechism itself.
Huh.
So that the title of the book both means I'm a believer, or I believe, because Anima Amin can be either of those things. And it plays off the title of the liturgical poem, which is the Orthodox Catechism.
You're a fellow for the Center for Hebraic Thought, and we're very proud to have you as somebody who would be willing to associate with us. I'm obviously a big fan of your scholarship, and we're talking today about your newest book called Anima Amim, Biblical Criticism, Historical Truth, and the 13 Principles of Faith, published by Magid, which is Magid an Israeli publisher?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And you begin in this book, in the introduction, you say something I think actually, well, I'm not sure. I think a lot of Christians would take this as a controversial claim, but I'm not sure how your main audience would hear it, Jewish readers. But you say, again and again throughout this book, ideas and terms that we take for granted as obvious, universal, and timeless turn out upon inspection to be contingent, a function of time and place. And then you name some concepts like, I love this list, by the way, belief, law, history, author, fact, fiction, story, religion, politics, that these are all like highly located terms that aren't really to be found directly in scripture. So how do you think this strikes your Jewish audience, I wonder, the statement that these ideas that we think are universal are actually more located and relative than we think?
Well, first let me say it's always a pleasure to be able to talk with you, Drew, and with the listeners to your podcast. I think that the audience that I had in mind, primarily people, my fellow co-religionists, would probably find it shocking, as I certainly did, as I discovered each one of these along the way. But I think that this is for me, hands down, the most exciting aspect of being a scholar. It's when you suddenly discover, in the most humbling way, how things that you think are so obvious are so rooted in time.
Yeah, you leave us hanging with that juicy tidbit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is one of the exciting things about being a scholar is the freedom to discover these things. And then I think that there's a fear that often comes maybe from some scholars, but maybe from the lay people when they hear, well, wait, this is all rooted in time. Then are these all just social constructions? And are we just left floating in a river of social constructions of ideas? And there's nothing universal?
There's that danger. But, you know, there's a danger on the other side, and that is anachronism. And that is forcing the Bible into pegs that it wasn't meant to be forced into in the first place. Look, let me just give one concrete example, okay, so that our audience can feel the power of what we're talking about. The Pentateuch says in a number of places that God took Israel out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Okay, now is that literal or not? Do you know that most believing Jews and Christians in the Middle Ages were certain that it was literal? After all, that's what it says. Now you and I, Drew, and I suspect most of our listeners would say, "No, come on, that's clearly, you know, just an image. It couldn't possibly be literal, right?" But you know, if you just take the words at their most literal meaning, our forefathers from the Middle Ages have more to back up their claim than we do. Okay? And I think that you know, it's by understanding ancient context, we can see what it really meant. And that was that this was stealing the thunder from the pharaohs, because the pharaohs, everything that they did, according to their inscriptions, was with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And what's really going on is not that God has a body, but that we are appropriating Egyptian, or the Torah is appropriating Egyptian royal propaganda and kind of using it as a kind of cultural resistance. So that you can see three different periods in time. You can see how maybe ancient Israelites in Egypt understood it. You can see how people in the Middle Ages understood this mighty hand and outstretched arm, and how most probably believing Jews and Christians today just said, oh, it's just a trope. It's just, you know, an image of God's strength. This should be humbling for us, that it is really important that we understand ancient context in order to best understand what Scripture is trying to tell us.
Yeah. How often do you spot these things? I mean, there is kind of a, you can read without knowing all of this and get the sense of what's going on in the text. But then someone like you, who's well ensconced in ancient Near Eastern literature, you see these things. How often do we need to be able to spot these things? And are we completely missing the meaning of the text if we didn't know that that was a particular pharaonic expression at one point in Egypt?
Right. So that particular instance, I guess the loss, if you don't know it, is rather minimal. But, you know, those that laundry list of really key concepts that you read off before, that our entire notion of the concepts fact, fiction, religion, politics, history, law, belief, none of these terms existed in the time of the Old Testament. And probably none of them existed in the time of the Talmud either, because we have no precise word that exactly has all the implications that we have from those words. So until you uncover, like, so what was going on, then this begins to have massive implications for understanding a lot of things.
Yes, and I understand you to mean also, when you say they didn't have a word for this, you mean more than just the literal word on the page. You mean, in many ways, the conceptual structure. So something like a religion, we have a very thick idea of what a religion is.
Right.
You know, when students say, well, were they religious? You say, you know, scholars, we typically go like, well, what do you even mean by that? Like they wouldn't even understand what you meant when you asked.
So let me just, for our audience, I'll lay that out. Yeah. When you don't find the power, you don't find a word in a culture for a word in your own culture, it means that conceptually something is a little bit different. Okay. So let's just take the word religion. Okay. Religion. There's no ancient word for religion, not in biblical Hebrew, nor in Egyptian, nor in Akkadian. None of the ancient languages had the word religious. That does not mean that they didn't believe in gods. They actually all believed in gods in one form or another. So how come they don't have a word religion? And here's the reason. Because in the ancient mindset, whether we're talking about ancient Israel or ancient Egypt or any other ancient culture, there is a large cosmic order. It involves all things. It involves relationships between man and wife, father and son, citizen and state, king and servant, and this god and that god, man and this god, the people and all the gods. It's all one big ecosystem. And so the gods are part of that. It's just the way of life. The idea that we have today that, oh, religion, well, that is the question of whether you have a belief in a god or a set of gods, and that's something that primarily is your own private business and something you do in your own private sphere. This is a very modern idea. It's, you know, 300 or 400 years old. The whole idea of separating church and state, religion from everything else around it, is a new idea, relatively speaking. This is where this modern idea of religion comes from, and why it would have been so foreign if we were talking or interviewing, you know, if you had Moses on your program instead of me, he wouldn't know, Drew, what religion meant, what you meant by that.
Let me throw one of the more difficult universal terms that you list into the mix. The one belief, I think, is probably one of the most problematic terms in the English language. Belief, or even worse, faith, right? Mm-hmm. So where do you, especially since this book is about believing something, where do you see the disconnect between modern Judaism or modern Anglo-American Christianity and what's going on in the Hebrew Bible?
Okay, so shockingly, there is no word for belief either. Not in rabbinic writings. By that I mean through the Talmudic period, let's say the seventh century or so, and not in the Bible itself. And this seems shocking because clearly all of these people in the Bible and all these rabbis in the Talmud clearly, in our terms, believed in God and believed, you know, a whole bunch of things, that the Torah was given at Mount Sinai, that there was an Exodus, and on and on. So what does it mean when we say that they didn't have beliefs? Okay, so for this, we need to back up a little bit. It isn't merely that the Hebrew Bible doesn't have a word for belief. There is no such word in any ancient culture in the ancient Near East of belief. Now, how could that be? And I think the answer is that the way in which they understood the types of things that we would call beliefs would be that they understood them in relational terms. What do I mean by that? If I were to say to you, Drew, can you list for me, so you have 23 years of experience under your belt. I'd like you to write down for me, Drew, the 10 most important principles of being married. Go. You wouldn't even know where to start. Right? And if you tried, you would begin, you'd erase, you'd go back. Now, I'd say, but Drew, you've been doing this for 23 years. And the answer is that formal formal postulates is just not what it's about. Rather, you have a deeply ingrained sense of what it is that's expected from you and what it is that you're supposed to do and what it is that you want your spouse to do. And the way in which it expresses itself is going to be a little bit different depending on each and every little nuance in a situation. In other words, if we just say, okay, let's see, the first commandment of marriage is communication. Everyone would agree that communication is really important in a relationship. But then immediately you can see the shortcomings of a phrase like that. Does that mean that I should tell my wife everything that's on my heart? Ooh, that would be very dangerous. Should I tell her immediately when I'm feeling these things? Equally dangerous. So, you know, there's no meaning to the word communication until you concretize the exact situation, and then intuitively you have a sense of what it is that you are meant to do. And I think that the way in which ancients thought about their relationship with divine powers was as a relationship. And so therefore there was nothing to affirm. It was lived. It was lived, and the devotion that was demanded by ancient gods, whether in Israel or whether outside of Israel, was expressed through a relationship and through action, and never required formal putting it into formal words. From what I understand, the first religion that really put an emphasis on beliefs and on giving formulas to these beliefs was actually Christianity. Now, this I'm just telling you what I've read, and I'm sure you would know better, and you can please correct me if I'm mistaken or if there's a debate about this. And the theory that I've read about this is that Christianity was the first religion that sought to win over hearts, to go out and bring people into the fold. This was an idea that was foreign to all other systems of belief prior to that, Judaism included. And if you're looking to win over adherents and get them to come and join the fold, well, you can't really insist that they do, as we have in Judaism, 613 different commandments. That's just too much. You'll never win over a lot of people that way. You have to make it relatively simple and you know, by just formulating key beliefs, telling people what it's about, you can win them over that way. And so this idea of catechisms, I believe, from what I've understood, starts with Christianity. So this is an example of how something that's so cardinal for us, when we go way back, we can actually trace its beginnings and why it began and how it's kind of different than where we are. And I would say that Judaism, even to this day, does not have the same commitment to set theologies as I often understand is the case in many Christian communities, in many Christian denominations. We can talk a little more about theology in Judaism, but there's always been a paramount emphasis on observance of the commandments as an expression of our devotion to the Almighty.
I think that's right. And I think in the New Testament, where you get the strong language of belief, pistis and pistuo, often mirroring the Septuagint's translation of aman and amunah, and that ben emet, the word group. There's been a pushback lately in New Testament scholarship, which I think is right, that the Gnostic view of that you just believe these things in your heart or your soul, and these will somehow gain you some salvation. You know, so scholars have pushed back recently and said, well, actually, you can replace almost every instance of pistis in the New Testament to believe or to have faith. You can replace it with the term allegiance or fealty, and that there really is this kind of
interesting, yes,
this political embodied obligation that's always inherent in it. And I think everything you said would actually dovetail quite nicely with the way Jesus teaches from the Torah. But you are not lying when you say there is a later Christian movement, especially if we're to be completely honest, the Greek Greco-Roman, as Christianity expresses itself in the Greco-Roman world, that pushes sometimes very near to this Gnostic view that you just believe these things in your heart. But it was an early heresy that got flirted with. But I think most people will be quick to point out that that in the biblical text, the New Testament, you see exactly what you described, which I'm glad you brought it because I want to move on to law next. But even in the statement of law, you might have a principled statement of law, like you shall not oppress your neighbor. But then that is never complete in of itself until you also have the concrete examples of what that looks like.
Right.
And sometimes they're very surprising examples, right? They turn the tables on you. Mm-hmm. So eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth is one of my favorites, because I think most of us think of that one as, at least in the Exodus expression of it, as, you know, if somebody does something to me, they will be paid back in kind. But the concrete examples that ensue are, if you abuse your slave, right? If you hit them in the eye, if you hit them in the tooth, right? So it kind of turns the tables on the one listening by making it concrete and filling it out. So yeah, I think you just did so much work across both testaments, I think, there. So speaking of law, I probably quote you more than anybody else now in my Hebrew Bible class. because I feel like law is the thing that is like chiefly misunderstood by Christians. They misunderstand Pharisees. They misunderstand the Pharisaical approach to the law. They misunderstand halachot. They essentially believe that the law is just a list of rules. It's do's and don'ts, and you either do or you don't, and everything shakes out accordingly. Could you help us understand why that might be an incomplete view of the law?
Yeah, what we see in just within the Torah, within the Pentateuch, is that the laws within the Pentateuch evolve. That is to say, God gives a certain number of laws to Moses at Sinai in Exodus chapters 21 to 23, otherwise known as the Covenant Code. And then we see that many of those laws reappear in Deuteronomy, but they seem to be updated. It's almost somewhat similar language, but the actual ruling is different. Now, for a really long time, scholars were convinced that therefore this is nothing but a contradiction, and it must be that there were different schools of law in ancient Israel that were at war with one another, and somehow these two schools of thought about all these various laws, for some reason, unbeknownst to us, were brought together, and voila, now we have the Pentateuch with all of its contradiction in law. And what I and others around me, too, have been pushing, and I think that this is a growing trend within the study of biblical law, is to say, no. Oh, it is true that the formulation of many of the laws in Deuteronomy are at odds with the formulation of those same laws that you will find in the Covenant Code. But you are mistaken to call this a contradiction, because what's really happening here is that even though things are expressed in the language of thou shall and do this and don't do that, which sounds absolute, sounds like what we would call statutory law. It's just frozen. It's written. This is what it is. So it is written, so it shall be done. It's not the way in which ancients anywhere thought about law. There is no ancient word for law in that sense of it's codified, it's written, you must do exactly as it's written. But rather, the way in which ancients thought about law is that they would discuss precedents that they had heard, and those would be ideas that be used by a judge for what to do at the present moment. And these could be updated. This is the key thing. The word of the Lord in the biblical laws is the first word. It's not the final word. And so even Moses in Deuteronomy is updating the laws that God had given in the covenant code, because Deuteronomy is written, stated, experienced, as far as what the book itself says, in the 40th year in the desert, as Israel is poised to enter into the land and face a whole new range of challenges. And so some of the laws that have been given earlier are now updated in order to accommodate the needs of the new time as they prepare to head into the land. So that the law is actually something that's very fluid and is given over to authorities in different ages to hopefully be faithful to the spirit of the law on the one hand, but always with the understanding that times do change. And therefore, the precise way to practice a given law will have to change as well.
Okay, so you mentioned the what do you do with conflict when you see two things in the text that seem to conflict, like the law. Obviously, many people will know that in the study of the Hebrew Bible for quite a while now, one solution to conflict has been to say, well, there are different authors and different schools and different redactors that have edited these things together. You use Noah's flood as an example, which most people in scholarship use it as kind of the prototypical example of a zippering together of two different accounts. Right. You know, you can almost take every other sentence and mm-hmm. pull apart these two different accounts. Mm-hmm. And you say, not so fast. Why not?
Well, because there are nine different problems methodologically with the way they do that. I'm not quite sure how quickly we can go through all of this.
Give us your top three.
Okay. The fathers of source criticism in the 19th century, and pardon my gender biased statement there, but they all happen to have been fathers.
Right.
Were all entirely ignorant of ancient Near Eastern writings because they hadn't been discovered yet. And one of the things, just to give one example of how once we are in touch with ancient Near Eastern writings, it changes the whole ball game. Many listeners might be familiar with the fact that in the Gilgamesh epic, at the end there is a flood story, which is remarkably similar to the biblical account. And what some scholars have noticed is that it's so similar that you can draw a kind of schematic outline of the flood account of the Gilgamesh epic and a schematic outline of the flood story of Genesis 6 to 9. And they both follow in order the same 17 steps with no gaps, like very little is left out. Now, that only holds if you are reading the text synchronically from beginning to end. So how did this perfect matchup come about if in fact the version that we have, the received version in the Masoretic text, is actually a conflation of no less than 27 snippets taken from two different sources that just so happens that when you zip them, voila, out we come with the perfect 17-step skeletal outline that you have exactly in the Gilgamesh epic. Okay? That has to.
So if I can summarize that point, because I think it's an important one. The view is that there's a couple of different sources that are being re-edited together and put in the final form that we see in the text today. And you're saying that, no, if you look at a parallel account, it follows it very closely, and that would only make sense if it's following the whole account, one person doing this.
Right.
The implication of that also is that it is following some other account or paralleling it in a way, and going back to your outstretched hand and a mighty arm.
Drew, I've lost you.
Are you there now? Can you hear
now
me?
Now I'm here. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I just saw you drop off for a second too. Mm-hmm. Going back to your outstretched hand and a mighty arm with the Pharaoh.
Yeah.
There again seems to be a rhetorical move being made here, not just that it's paralleling this other story, but it's paralleling it for some grander purpose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry. So then one of the next major points that you saw that is problematic with saying this is multiple sources?
Okay, is this. Source critics are confident not only that there are fissures in the text, contradictions, which might be fairly plain to the eye, but that they have the capacity to recreate what the texts looked like in their earlier forms. Okay, now source critics on the Bible, on the flood story, all admit that at least one of the two versions that we have is not a complete story in itself, that we have gaps. The so-called non-priestly version doesn't have, a call to build the ark. It doesn't have an account of Noah disembarking from the ark. And so they solve for that by saying, well, the redactor only chose selectively from the non-priestly source in putting together the text that we have before us in Genesis 6 to 9. So already source critics all admit that we don't have the whole of the source that we had before. But then how is there any confidence that what we have before us is made up entirely of exactly the ipsissima verba, the very same words as what those prior sources had? Because you cannot say, well, the redactor, he sought to take these two hallowed traditions and felt that they were both so hallowed that he could leave nothing out and therefore wove them in this way. But they're already admitting that there are parts missing, that the redactor actually did not have fidelity to using everything that was in his purported earlier source. And if that's the case, then how do source critics know that the redactor never changed anything? Forget about deleting, omitting. Maybe there were things that the redactor changed. And if there were phrases, if there were verses, if there were passages that the redactor was responsible for changing, then it is no longer possible to ever get back to those earlier sources. So this attempt to, it's the holy grail of what biblical studies have been about for 200 years. Get back to the earlier sources, understand how the text came to be, understand the ideas, the history of the ideas. It's a very noble idea, but it's not an accident that we have the very same issues in all other areas of ancient study. That is, that we have texts just like our Masoretic text, received text in all our Bibles. We don't have the original. And in many other cultures, they have copies of copies of copies, like our Bibles are. And in no other ancient field of study that I am aware of, not classics, not Egyptology, not Assyriology, never do scholars in those fields say, ah, we have a copy of a copy of a copy of a received text, and we are now going to disassemble the text and claim what the earlier precursors of that text looked like. They used to try that with classics. They gave up on that about 100 years ago. So that this is a kind of exercise which only survives to this day in the field of biblical studies.
And you're not suggesting, if I hear you correctly, that there should be no attempt at all to think about various sources for text. And some texts demand that you think about them because they tell you, hey, we got this from the book of Yashar or
Sure.
The Deeds of the Kings. So thinking that there is still obviously some compilation of text, but it's this going the further step of saying, oh, it's because this tribe who lived here, who had this power, authority, control of these texts over this time and then blended it in this way. It's the specificity that becomes problematic.
The degree of resolution that's problematic. I'll just give one more example that I like to cite, but there's nine. Okay, this is just the third. It's what I call the Chronicles challenge. Okay, here's the Chronicles challenge. We know that the chronicler had some version that's pretty close to our version of Samuel and Kings in front of him, because there are so many passages in the book of Chronicles which are, you know, more than 90 or 95% identical to the parallel accounts that appear in the Forlaga, in the earlier books of Samuel and Kings. Here's the Chronicle, here's the Chronicle challenge, okay, for source critics. Imagine that you take all of First Chronicles, okay? And you take all of the parallel accounts that you have in Samuel and Kings, and you note very, very carefully, how does the chronicler depart from those earlier versions? And you kind of make like an algorithm. Oh, he always does this. He leaves that out. He changes this. And you have a lot of data there. Okay. And you see, you have, it's all empirical. You can see what the chronicler did given his original texts of Samuel and Kings. Okay. Now you take your formula for what the chronicler does to his source. Can you use that formula now when you turn to Second Chronicles? And based on the formula that you derived, as we described before, can you now recreate the parallel stories from Second Chronicles that were in the Book of Kings? You cannot. You cannot. And you have all the information there in front of you. So if you can't recreate the Book of Kings parallel to Second Chronicles based on all the data you had about what the chronicler did in First Chronicles relative to his parallel sources, what gives anyone the right to say that you can state with confidence what an earlier source looked like relative to any book, whether it's Genesis or whether it's Exodus or whatever? If that was clear enough.
It is, well, at least to me, and I think the problem that you're outlining here is, well, the bigger problem that I see in biblical studies with the issue of sources is there really is not any control.
Exactly.
And what you're saying is let's find some points of control, like you did with the Kadesh Barnea Stella in your former book. And let's just apply the rules. And you have offered some degree of controlled experiments with the Tiberius Project, right? We're using the stylometry to kind of run experiments on what you should expect and not. And is it fair to say that there's not necessarily resistance to this? It's the worst. There's almost silence on this desire for putting some control experiments in there.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. These arguments that we've been mentioning now about, let's say, the flood account in Genesis 6 to 9, I wrote this up in my earlier book from 2017, which was the academic version of this book that we're discussing this evening. That academic book was called Inconsistency in the Torah, Ancient Literary Convention and the Limits of Source Criticism. Okay, so that's been out now 3 years, and it's had about 15 reviews, and all of those reviews have been positive. And I will tell you, Drew, that is bad news. That is bad news. Now, when did you last hear an author say, wow, I've had so many good reviews, and that's bad news?
Yeah, you're going to have to explain that to our audience.
Yeah. here is why it's bad news. I know that there are many scholars that will not accept the arguments that I've made, but they don't write, they don't respond, not in reviews and not in their own writing about these issues. And it underscores for me what is a scourge in our field, maybe other fields too. I'm not the only one to express this, that in just the same way, Drew, that in what we see in the wider culture, if you read the New York Times, you probably don't tune into Fox News. And if you're tuning into Fox News, you probably don't pick up the New York Times. People tune into what they want to hear. And often with source critics, they are reading source critical approaches and anything that's coming from outside that. certainly anything that might, you know, pull the rug out from under the, you know, the foundations of that approach is just not read. The example that I gave before to you, Drew, about how the flood account in the Gilgamesh epic, in tablet 11 of the Gilgamesh epic, is parallel 17 steps to what goes on in Genesis 6 to 9. This was first laid out in the mid 80s, and there is in a very prominent journal, and there is strikingly little discussion of that man's claims anywhere in the source critical material to Genesis 6 to 9. He's just off the radar, even though he published in a very, very prestigious journal. So this is a problem in the academy as well. I have heard source critical scholars say the same thing. You guys haven't read my work. Say that to one another. So I'm not saying that this is something about source. It's probably endemic to many aspects of our culture, unfortunately. But when I see that all the reviews are positive, it's a little disappointing.
Yes, and it's that work and this work that you've written for lay people now, it's hard to just reconcile it into the program. You really have to wrestle with the details of the argument. So I've seen this in philosophy as well, you know, where somebody just makes a smackdown point that really undercuts a lot of broad thinking, and then they get ignored for 150 years. I think it is endemic to scholarship some degree. I think there's something unusual about biblical scholarship, as you noted, because I've hung around Egyptologists and Assyriologists now, and I realize they don't, you know, when you explain this to them, what's going on, they kind of look at you sideways and say, why are you doing this? Like, what's going on?
Right. And isn't that refreshing or humbling, you know, things that we all take or that our discipline takes as, you know, just Torah from Sinai, if you will, as just axiomatic. Outside of our guild, people don't really understand why we're doing what we're doing. Yep.
It's a good argument for a healthy interdisciplinary method.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, finally, before I cut you loose, while we have your brain and your wisdom here, the last part of this book, Enigma Amim, is all about the Mishneh Torah and the Rambam and the principles he's developed for belief, as you put it. First of all, who is the Rambam? That's his street name, right? Rambam.
That's Maimonides. That's just yeshiva speak for Maimonides. Yeah.
Yeah. And not to be confused with the Ramban as well.
Right, but I don't think I mentioned him. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I learned that the hard way.
Okay, wow.
And what are these 13 principles, and why are they so important to Jewish thought? Why are these principles from medieval Jewish thought so important for Jewish thought today?
Okay, so Drew, I mentioned earlier that in the Bible, there's no list of what you have to believe, you know, a catechism, and not in the Talmud either. The Talmud has a lot of things in it, but you will never find a catechism of what you have to believe. What happens is that this kind of didactic tool of a catechism, obviously, as you mentioned, you know, becomes very, very central in Christianity and later in Islam. And I think that Jewish thinkers in the Middle Ages saw the power, the didactic power of having just, you know, a little book of what you're meant to, you know, what are the main ideas. And there are early attempts at that. And Maimonides made his own list as well. The truth is, Maimonides, he lived in the 12th century. And there wasn't a whole lot of attention paid to his list of these 13 principles, which are mostly, they're about basically three issues. They're about prophecy. They're about God, about prophecy, and kind of about reward and punishment. They're groups of threes, basically. These principles were not a huge part of Judaism for a really long time. They became much, much more central, I would say, around the time of Jewish emancipation, the late 18th and early 19th centuries, when Jews were figuratively and literally released from the ghetto and brought into the mainstream of European life and given the option of living any lifestyle they chose. And many, many Jews decided they would just wanted to be French or German citizens and, you know, leave leave behind the tradition. This became enormously threatening for rabbinic authorities who were still adhering to the tradition, and especially once new forms of Judaism began to emerge, such as Reform Judaism in the early 19th century. Jews who wanted to have some type of religious structure, but in a very different way, practice would be greatly changed, beliefs would be greatly changed. And now suddenly, Maimonides' list of 13 principles was rocketed. Its stock value, as it were, rocketed within rabbinic literature, because now this would become the litmus test. Are you inside the fold or are you outside the fold? Well, it'd be very easy to tell. Do you hold by these principles or not? And so it's really on the last couple hundred years that these principles have soared to the status that they have today as a kind of a litmus test of whether you're in or out. That's where it begins.
Judaism in general, and even specifically Enlightenment Judaism and beyond, there's been a resistance to think of themselves as theological in the way that Christians have typically thought about themselves as theological. And I don't know if you've read Jim Diamond's book, Jewish Theology Unbound, but it's a great little argument. That the Hebrew Bible itself, he begins in Genesis 3 and 4 and says it demands right there kind of a philosophical reflection in order to understand what God is even talking about.
Right.
So I think most Christians are going to say, well, if they don't really see themselves as theological, and even these belief statements are bare bones belief statements in some ways, they're just the basic, like you said, litmus test, then what do they have instead of theology?
Well, instead of theology, we have what Jews have always had, which is the halakha, the way of life that they're living, which is regulated and governed down to minutia in every aspect of life.
And so the proper expression of life is also thinking about life in terms of what the rabbis and the communities have wrestled with. And if I have this right, is both how much do we reach back in the past to think about how we improvise, you know, what we're allowed to do, and then how much do we, you know, express more freely or less restrained.
There's that. But I just want to underscore that when I say that the mainstay of traditional Judaism has always been practice, it isn't rote practice devoid of you know, what it all means or what it's meant to do to the heart and to the soul. It's just what I said. You know, communication with your wife is going to be concretized in an action that is tailor made for the situation. And so it is with the way in which Orthodox Judaism will view a devotion to God, that it is expressed through the study of Torah, through prayer, through charitable deeds, through living in the land of Israel, as I have the blessing to do. And all of these things together are an expression of the things that we hold dear, rather than just saying, okay, here's the one-line formulation. Yeah, I hold that too.
Yeah, I think it's important. And I think Christians, I get a sense, you know, I have a couple of books on rituals and when I go out and speak on those, I get a sense that Christians are actually much more open to the profundity of rote, not seeing it as merely rote rituals and turning off your brain and doing this thing, but actually that it enables a new way of seeing the world.
It absolutely does, yes.
More so than I would have seen 2 decades ago, I guess, in American Christianity. So that's encouraging as well. That ultimately Christian theology is its physical practice as well, which I would say is just the story of Scripture from beginning to end. Well, it has been a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending your time with us and helping us to understand. I always enjoy hearing everything you have to say. And I
always a pleasure,
hope Drew. You have a blessed week.
Right. Okay, friends. Yes, we should all be granted assistance in dealing with the difficult times we're in on all the fronts, in weathering the health scare, and in finding ways to embrace one another. Thank you, Drew, for this opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at hebraicthought.org.